Welcome to My African Aesthetic, a podcast that interrogates the African aesthetic in African architecture and design.
On this podcast, you'll hear about the work, philosophy, and design process of African architects and designers practicing in Africa and the diaspora.
My name is Eunice Nanzala Schumacher. I'm a Ugandan architect and designer living and working in Norway.
And my name is Penina Achayo-Laker. I am a Ugandan graphic designer, researcher, and educator living and practicing in the USA.
Our podcast features conversations with designers working to provide architecture and design solutions for Africa.
We would like this to become a platform where our guests share their knowledge and experiences on designing in the diverse, hybrid, and dynamic socioeconomic, cultural, and political African context.
We are looking forward to embarking on this journey with you. Our guest today is Henry Mainsha. He is a media and design scholar currently working as a researcher at the Institute for Consumption Research at the Oslo Metropolitan University in Norway. He has over 15 years of research experience. He is originally from Cameroon and has lived, studied and worked in different African and European contexts. His research interests include interdisciplinary research methods, digital media, design, identity, digital literacies and youth culture. His publications are available in print and on the internet. Today, we will dive into different topics. We will talk about design research and how it complements design practice, social media design and its relevance to showcasing African design and designers, and African identity and design. Thank you for joining us today, and we hope that you enjoy this episode. Henry, thank you very much for joining us today on My African Aesthetic podcast.
Thank you, Eunice, and thank you, Penina, for having me. It's a pleasure. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Would you please tell us about yourself, about your upbringing, and about maybe some events and moments in life that you remember were significant and were a turning point for you in regard to design, sure, but also generally life?
Sure. So my name is Henry. I was born in Cameroon, in the English-speaking part of Cameroon. I was a former British protectorate. So yeah, I don't know if everybody listening is aware of that history, but Cameroon was former German colony. And after the First World War, after the defeat of Germany, Cameroon was one of the territories, the former German colonies in the West, in Africa, particularly in West Africa, that was ceded over to Britain and France. So before it was one and it was split into two, and part of it, majority was given to France, and there's a small part of Cameroon that was given to Britain as a protectorate, and it was attached to Nigeria at that time. And when it was when the independence came, we had a referendum, and we had to ask us whether we wanted to join Nigeria or Cameroon, and the majority chose Cameroon. And I'm not aware of all the conditions, whether it's like the level of information that people had on the choices that they had to vote for, but the choices were limited because it was either you choose to be part of Nigeria or you choose to be part of Cameroon. So I went to school there up to secondary school, and then I went to travel to Nigeria to study. It originally was to study a pre-law program for 3 years. And after that, I decided I changed my mind. I didn't want to study law anymore. So I came back to Cameroon, and then I found this opportunity in Norway. So I actually, when I came to Norway, I studied media and communication. So that was in Trondheim. And I moved to Oslo, the capital, and I took a master's media communication and a doctorate in media communication. So, and how did I get from there to design research? It was just by chance that there was a colleague of mine at that time that we kind of were collaborating together, and he was awarded the position as a professor of design in a Oslo School of Architecture and Design. He invited me to continue a project that we started where we were at the University of Oslo. So I when I went there and I discovered that there was a very great need for somebody with a social science background that had a good understanding of methods, of research methods. Now, during my stay at Oslo Software Architecture and Design, I developed research that connected social sciences and design in relation to methods. And I proposed and participated in several projects to build up that competence in the resource we were having at that time, because methods was not really a very explicit part of the design curriculum for my bachelor's and master's and even doctorate at that time. So we did we developed some course content both for the bachelor, master's, and also for the PhD level. So I had participated a lot in the PhD school at Architecture and Design, and I also briefly for 1 year I was the coordinator of the PhD program. So that's pretty much how I moved from media to communication to design. And of course, I have interests. I mean, I have research interests that kind of connected design and media communication, because I was doing a lot of research on youth and digital media. And so there was interdisciplinary study of media, digital media. It was difficult to separate what use of media and making of media. So the making of media became a part of that. The attempt to join media consumption and media production was kind of how I connected that interest and my competence from media studies into design. So I had also sort of action and design. I participated in quite a few projects. There was one project on the design of social media for young people to increase citizen engagement. In that project, we were designing social media solutions to help organizations. In that case, there was a newspaper, there was a humanitarian organization involved in that project, and there was the public service broadcaster was one of the projects, the NLCO, public service broadcaster was one of the partners. So we designed together with media and design students and also researchers. We collaborated with organizations to help them to design kind of strategies for social media to increase civic engagement. So that was one of the kind of projects that I did when I was in social media design. I did other projects on climate change and the development of methods to help elicit people's experiences of the changes brought about by the changes in both the environment and also in society brought about by climate change. So one of the projects I involved a collaboration between Oslo School of Architecture and Design and the Cape Peninsula University of Technology. So we had student exchanges, we had joint research, we had kind of students visiting from Cape Town to Oslo and also to Cape Town. And we had some research expeditions from Cape Town to Namibia, for example, where students built this tiger fish sculpture and went on a journey, using them as a kind of a boundary object to interact with communities along that coastline, to kind of to gather the stories about the experiences of climate change. I'm telling you this because I just want to give some examples of kind of work I'm doing and how this my interests are kind of connected. My interest in media studies, the studies of youth, the studies of media, the studies of methods, participatory methods, all connected together. Kind of.
I really appreciate those examples, Henry. And I think what you're doing too is helping to paint a picture of the diversity of ways that creatives, whether it's designers, architects, can actually work. I think what you're doing is also introducing what scholarship looks like. And for our listeners, Henry is heavily published. He's a researcher to the core, and we'll link your academic profile from the Oslo School of Architecture and Design so people can see the many publications you have written on a lot of the work that you've done. And so it sounds like a lot of this is very participatory work. It's collaborative. It requires teams coming together. You talked about bridging your interests in design with the social sciences and how there is this really great opportunity for makers and thinkers to learn about methodological practices and approaches to the way we create and come up with solutions and ideas. I guess just from a more general sort of point of view, I'm curious if you could share with our listeners how one can go about curating a pathway for themselves to become a design researcher. Granted that, you know, yours comes in from, you went all the way from pre-law in Nigeria to like leaving that to coming to Norway and studying media and communication, and then found your way to doing more design research work and getting a doctorate that way. What are some pathways that young people can take?
Well, I would say that I personally wouldn't recommend others to follow my example, because it was a very, very, very unnecessarily long journey. But the reason why it happened that way, and I cannot really kind of, when you ask me, I kind of, it forces me to think about it right now. I think that one of the reasons that it happened that way was because I've never been comfortable positioning myself within one field. So that kind of explained why I was found interest in different fields, and that was how I was navigating between different fields. Mm. And right now it's both a blessing and a curse. Yes, and kind of the tendency to want to kind of put you in a particular box. It's hard to fit me in the box. So I'm saying that to the fact that when it comes to thinking about the path that some of the listeners might want to take to kind of to get to be kind of a general researcher. There are many ways to go in about it. There's a classic way, of course, you start from design and in design. So you take the courses, the bachelor. In all sorts of architecture and design, there is a joint bachelor and master's program, by the way. So you start you take a 5-year mm-hmm. program, you start from bachelor, and then you end with a master's degree. So that's mm-hmm. that's the classic part, that's what most students take. Just to tell, there are other ways to get ways of getting there, like my example illustrates. But it has its advantages and its disadvantages.
Yeah, I think what's interesting that you said is you knew you were the kind of person that was interested in not just one specific area of study, that you were interested in multiple areas of study. And I think when you think about 21st century learning skills today, we see a lot of young people interested in multiple topics, multiple disciplines. And I think it's important for them to know that there is a way to start thinking about how you can start to like exist in both, in two disciplines at a time. Yes, it's not always the easiest. It's interdisciplinary, sometimes even multidisciplinary, cross, even transdisciplinary. But that could be an indicator if you're kind of person who, you know, is really interested in like two disciplines or maybe three. You're saying that when it comes to like the creative fields, there is a way you could do that. Maybe being a researcher, you could add to that body of knowledge. You could help shape what that thing might be. Right?
Absolutely. And it's increasingly being recognized now that, especially within design research,
there's a
strong need for that interdisciplinary knowledge, because the kind of problems that designers are dealing with are kind of interdisciplinary in nature. So it would require collaborations with engineering, geography, literature, art, economics. So it requires, and I'm saying that it's a particularly needed but also very, very challenging skill to have. Because if you are educated within one field, you're not aware of it, but you come with a certain a historical baggage that's kind of built in that discipline. The way the kinds of concepts, they construct the concepts, the way their research practices happen, what is recognized as good research or not good research, the perspectives that they take on the questions that they ask, all kind of characteristics of disciplines that are not necessarily explicit when you're studying them.
Yes.
But when you come into dialogue with other disciplines, that you discover that you have different ways of saying things. In order to find that common ground, it's usually very challenging.
You're bringing up ideas of, you know, to be a good collaborator amongst people with various disciplines, you need to be ready to be a good translator of what you do, making sure that people understand what this thing is that you do. Because I think sometimes, especially in design, I feel like we assume people know what designers do or what designers are, but that's not often the case, especially when they see designers existing in research spaces. They're like, what exactly does research have to do with design in this case? So being a good translator, being ready to compromise where, you know, if it's a collaboration, that it's not about like, oh, this is my one idea. And if it's not that idea, then I'm not bought in. So being able to compromise. What else have you found to be some good attributes or characteristics that someone has to have to be a good collaborator?
Okay, so the first, that your question makes me to think about, it's this tendency I noticed within design to see things in terms of dichotomies. So there's a tendency to separate between a designer and a researcher, design research and social science research, theory and practice, research methods and design methods, as if mm-hmm. those things polarize so easily, and which they don't. So that's mm-hmm. part of, and because design is a discipline that's still like struggling to place itself within the other very traditional disciplines. There's a tendency to have the kind of a very closed view that want to protect. This is what design is. This is what it's not. And that's a challenge when it comes to when you think about this kind of collaborations that we've been talking about so far. Because you will have to require that you kind of have this kind of change in your kind of and be comfortable to say something about translation. I think that's a kind of a particular skill that's very, very, very in high demand right now, and also particularly difficult to learn. Mm-hmm. And I think that the easiest way, I would say, the most obvious way of learning is by practice.
Yeah.
Placing yourself in those contexts where that require you to speak with other disciplines. This is something that within the design education, they're realizing that there's a need to place design students in those kind of situations where they have to speak to other disciplines. They have to kind of make explicit the assumptions behind the ideas in the discipline. And mm-hmm. also being able to speak in a way that others understand, and also being able to understand the other discipline. So that's something that I see many design teachers and design researchers recognizing as important now. But it's not; it's far from being kind of really ingrained in the both in terms of pedagogy and research.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something it's really necessary to learn in this current day, especially because. The kinds of questions that designers have been calling to answer, design researchers have been called to answer, are just kind of very, very complex, multi-contextual. So it's also just about discipline. It's also about kind of being able to understand different contexts and different worldviews.
Henry, there is another subject that we would like to discuss with you and just hear your thoughts about, and that is publishing.
We are lacking tangible information, for young people to get inspired, but also archiving. What do you think is the most relevant or most appropriate publishing avenue in the context of African design and architecture?
That is an excellent question. It's an excellent question because it kind of touches on one of the challenges of our current new liberal university, right? There's this model that's also dominating all over the world right now. And that's viewing, they're putting an emphasis on productivity, and productivity is measured by researchers about the amount of publications that you have to publish. Although these publications are read by very, very few people.
That is very true.
And it's written in a language that only the kind of the very, very the initiated understand. Yep. So then there's the question of this, the value of this form of this dissemination. So that is a bit. We are forced, because we live in this neoliberal times, in order to progress in your career, to have to publish, right? But that's that's not necessarily the only and also the most appropriate forms of sharing your knowledge and disseminating your knowledge. That's one. And so it's very important besides being able to publish and show that you are you can produce research of good scientific quality. I think there is an ethical imperative for us researchers to be able to kind of share knowledge among different audiences that are not necessarily academic, and be able to translate. You talk about translation. This is another form of translation that we need to kind of learn to practice. Like translate your academic work into a language that's accessible to the non-academic audiences. And it's very important if you want to think about impact, and this is another kind of very coded word. But I mean, this is also very, very, very present. That's, I mean, you have to think about how to give yourself, your research, some meaning, making it accessible to kind of, yes. And so, although for my, in my case, I because of the conditions in which you're working with, you have to publish a lot. So I have been trying to do that. But at the same time, I've been trying to explore ways of collaborating with other, other people that are not academics and not in academic projects. So I'm using my knowledge to work with people that are outside of academia and kind of to collaborate with them and kind of share what I've learned and also make that valuable in different ways. I provide the research that goes into the production of works of art. So, and I also introduce them to participating methods to enable artists to produce art in a collaborative nature. So it's not just the art that's the artist that can produce the art, but they can bring others to the project into that process. So the knowledge I've gained from these research methods and participating methods, I bring into those collaborations and kind of help the kind of to design processes that can help artists, for example, provide collaborative platforms.
For me, I think design research is perfect in this age. If the information is accessible for the African market, then we can only imagine the finesse of the products or the services that will be produced.
I find that kind of that what you have said very, very, very interesting and relevant. And it's because, and it's connected to this issue, although I don't always like the way it's framed, but this issue of decolonizing in academia. So this idea that the valuable forms of knowledge in design research do not already exist in those centers that we consider those kind of the West, for example, and that there are many practices that are not necessarily known. Because, for example, if you think about researchers, for example, what they are, the demands of researchers in African universities, for example, and the lack of time to write publications, and also, so that's within the academic world, but within practice, there are so many skills and forms of knowledge that are embedded in practices that are not necessarily communicated. And also, even when they're communicated, when they come into the kind of the global public space, they're labeled as not as being kind of, I don't know, arts and craft, not design. So it's like that. So it's not giving the value. And so it's, that's also, that's this kind of, what value do we ascribe to the forms of knowledge production that would happen in many, many parts that are kind of the margins of what we consider the kind of, consider as global knowledge, which is not global. And also this, the fact that we have to kind of exist in systems where kind of, where there are certain prerogatives, where kind of it pushes the researcher to want to do certain type of things, to produce certain things in certain ways that are not necessarily accessible to everybody else. The end product of that is that knowledge exists in many different kind of scattered areas, not always accessible, but even when it's accessible, so it's not as always like accorded value. And so there's a lot of work, I think, and I'm very, 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 very interested in that. So one of the ways I do that, first of all, is kind of writing quite a bit about this, what is considered as design. Just that. So the distinction between what is design and what is, for example, I don't know, traditional craft or whatever it is. That's important because it's like there are certain things that are excluded.
Absolutely.
Yes. And so it's like it's so then this what is considered as design just becomes a very limited within limited scope. So there's also the challenge of making different forms of knowledge accessible. Not necessarily to the centers in the West, but also to other African countries, because I think that's the biggest challenge of decolonization, I think, in my view. It's about opening Africa onto itself. That's something that my compatriot Achim Bembe talks a lot about. It's about opening up Africa to itself, making kind of that circulation of not necessarily people, but also knowledge within the continent itself. I think that would make a big difference. Mm-hmm. Because the person in Cameroon, the artist or designer in Cameroon, is not necessarily connected to what's happening in Kenya or Tanzania or the Congo. First of all, because it's very difficult to travel from one place to another. That's one of the reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And also because there's this circulation of books, magazines, all those kind of things. Very, very difficult because of the kind of really, I'm really passionate and interested in. I don't have the answers so far, but that's something that's kind of really kind of like is capturing my mind right now.
And sometimes it starts with not necessarily having the answers, but asking the right question and knowing what the question is to ask. And even I think just that the fact that you're fascinated with thinking about how we define what design is and who gets to determine what design is, because you know, even just Africa in itself, we are not a monolith. You know, we're not one culture. You know, we are so many ethnicities in Africa, and there's a kind of diversity that comes into question when we're thinking about, you know, how people make, how people use products, services, materials. So, you know, you're right. I think we need to whereas we can talk about decolonizing, you know, our education and the design curriculum, I think it's also part of that is also like broadening the scope. It's thinking about, you know, what has been excluded, you know, that actually is design. And in fact, is it, if it's not design, what else is it? You know, do we even have to call it design in the first place? But I think what matters is that it has to also be, we have to think about how we can elevate our own, you know, products, services, experiences, and think about how we can contribute those to the global stage and not feel so restricted in those boundaries that was sort of, you know, set upon us, you know, in a more colonial sort of period of time. So we bring with us an identity that is complex now, you know, because I remember there was a time when I was in grad school, I was so fascinated in thinking about what would design look like void of any colonialistic or, you know, any attachments to colonialism. And, you know, and for a long time, I found myself in this rabbit hole of thinking about like, what are those practices that we, you know, we ascribe to pre-colonial days, but also like, where is that knowledge? Because a lot of that knowledge is hard to find. And I had to come to a place where I had to accept that, like, perhaps it's not so much me thinking about design apart from that history, but thinking about what that now means for me with this, because this colonial history is also now part of our history. And how can we start to like forge new ways to define what we do and think about, you know, what we contribute, because there's a wealth there too, a wealth in that diversity. But you're right, it's very complex. But I think we just start by asking those tough questions.
Yeah, absolutely. And I agree with you that there's there's a big archive, especially in the African context, because of the experiences of colonization that has been unexplored. It's not only valuable just for Africans, but also for the world in general. There's this rich archive that's still not fully explored.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, although it's very interesting to explore this kind of unexplored archives from that period we had mentioned, but yet pre-colonial Africa is not waiting statically to be discovered.
Exactly.
It has never been stable, right? It has always been, because there has always been history. This has been evolving over time. So you cannot just separate pre-colonial, colonial, and post-colonial.
It doesn't work like that.
Yes. So history doesn't play it out like that. So you have to, it's like we have, this is part of us now. All that is part of us.
Mm.
But the question is like, how do we go into those confined to things that we have not kind of really explored, that were part of us, but that actually are not part of us? How do we kind of build on that? And it's not to copy, but to actually to get inspired from that, and see and be able to see things differently, see the world differently. That I think is what I find interesting.
Mm.
And this, I guess, brings us to African identity and design. How does identity affect how we design?
I think that I will put it in terms of how does experience and our context shape how we see things, right? That's how I think about it. So because our experience and history and our experience shapes our material conditions, but also shapes how we see ourselves. I just want to demystify that notion of identity because I want to kind of make it like that it's not necessarily an abstract thing. It's about your history that you're not necessarily your experience that you're not necessarily always conscious of, but that's part of you and that shapes how you see the world. So being in touch with that, I think, is kind of it's very important when you're thinking about it. You can see that in the work, in kind of in design and architecture in many ways. I was reading this. Written by this architect, David Ajayi, architecture. I went and I bought the book and I was looking through it. It's quite interesting just by putting the works from different parts of African countries in one publication. Just by that, how radical an idea, just that simple thing is. Because it shows you how similar and how different kind of we are from country to country in Africa and from region to region, and it shows the kind of richness of our creativity, our history, and that's reflecting all in Africa in architecture. And it's in architecture that you see that history that we talked about all the part of our experience being manifested. From the kind of the past, far past away till the colonial experience to the current, is you can see that very, very clearly how things are, houses are built and how structures are built in many, many parts of Africa. It showed me that you can use architecture to tell that story. It tells a story of how people, where we came from and how we came. Yes. So there are things that are structures that are preserved and not too well, but some of them are preserved well. But we're still within that. If you look at that, you will see how history has evolved in how the way architecture is. And then the way the architecture kind of is. And I'm not talking just about the big cities, but you can go to kind of the rural areas and see how things used to be built. Yeah. I remember when I went to home to Cameroon. So there's this, in our compound, there's this stone wall. That's kind of used to make the gates. There's this kind of really a technique of putting a stone, like a building with stone. So I was asking, there was a guy I saw in a compound doing some repair work. I was asking him whether he could do that. He couldn't do it anymore because it's like, it would be very difficult to find people that can do that kind of build that structure in the whole town that we're talking about. So I asked him, it's like, where can I find people that can do something similar as it. He couldn't answer. And he said, it's like, it's very difficult to find because they don't do that anymore. But I found it very beautiful. I found this very, not only beautiful, but very, very like a very practical structure because it's very adapted to the environment it is. There's a lot of, for example, a lot of building practices that involve, for example, using mud. And it's like, so if you go to a compound, my grandfather's house, my compound in a village, my grandfather's house, it stands beside my parents and my uncle's house. My grandfather's house is built with that very pure mud. My parents' house is built with bricks. So in the same compound, you have to see that this difference exists. Yeah. And the one thing is like, we want you to notice that when you go to enter that and you stay in that, it's very, very cool. Very cool inside. If you go to a kind of house, it's much my parents. It's a much modern structure. It's like I don't know where the plan was taken, but it's beautiful like outside. It's very, very hot because it's not so adapted to the kind of the climate that we're just building. But you look at that, it's like that's looked down upon that traditional building looked down upon. But strangely enough, it's actually was very, very practical. Both ecologically and also kind of, it's very good for the environment. It's very, very adapted to the environment. If you ask my grandfather why they built it that way, he wouldn't tell you, of course. but he just knew that that was how they were building things, and that's how they built it, and it worked for them that way. And you don't know why it changed. And so you see those examples, I mean, those clear examples in a lot in architecture, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. And that's what that book I was talking about, that book, Ajay's book, kind of really just made me kind of more.
And it also sounds like, I think what you've touched on too is going back to the question you were saying about publication or sharing our, you know, innovations or thoughts. Like for a lot of us on the continent, it's in the built environment. It's in the way we build. It's in the way we create those products. And whereas, yes, they might not necessarily be, you know, in textbooks yet, and I think we're seeing more Africans, you know, documenting and writing about them, they exist. That knowledge exists. And so I'm also fascinated by how you as a researcher took on looking at David Ajay's book and almost doing like a visual analysis to better understand, you know, the fabric of architecture and what that has to teach us about our own identity, about our own culture backgrounds. And I'm curious what if there are some other, I say, like methodological approaches or practices or, you know, sort of best practices that you try to include in your own practice, but also maybe you have found through research are really important for designers, architects to consider when they're thinking about creating product services that are relevant to those social contexts that they're trying to design for. What are some other ways that we can go about doing that?
So there are two ways. So the first one is, the designers are becoming more and more good at this now, but it's not always the case. Being able to articulate the embodied and embedded skills that they employ in their work.
Mm.
So when we talk about methods, it's like there's never the discussion never goes touches those things that like, they just know how to do. Like things that they can draw, the kind of the styles of drawing, the styles of making. Those things are very, very embedded. Mm. And so one of the things I do is to try to get them not just students, design students that are making things, but also practitioners to be able to articulate those kinds of embodied and embedded skills that they have. One. And secondly, a lot of my work has been focused on giving design researchers and design students and practitioners tools to be able to understand the people and the environments that they're designing, they're working within. So it's and I do that not just through this classic research methods courses, but I try to basically just giving people like adapted instruction about methods that they can use in their own practice to really understand people and the environment which are discovering. And so it's not just about people, it's about the meaning of things, right? The cultural meanings of things that are different from place to place. So it's not just through the classic research methods course that I use. It's mostly more kind of very close collaborative work where we develop these things together, those tools together that they can use. I've done that in projects. I've done that also in collaboration with practitioners. I've done that in my work with artists. And I've done that with kind of also, work with students and also teachers also.
The last time we talked, we touched on things like tapping into our local archives of knowledge on the continent, documenting and communicating, you know, the invisible and visible forms of knowledge and cultural heritage. And I remember you bringing up the question, are we asking the right questions? I remember that also from our previous conversations. And then you also touched on us being conscious. When we say a human-centered design, who is in the center?
Mm-hmm.
And I see these messages coming back again right now when we're talking to you on the podcast. But I would like for you to talk a little bit more about first asking the right questions with the lens of a design researcher who has worked with designers. I'm keen to hear what you have to say about that.
Yeah, sure. So one of the ways in which I do this is, and I get this from the studying of feminists, Afro-feminists, literature, from cultural studies, from post-colonial studies. I draw on that to articulate the need to understand. It's like, as when you are invited to this particular situation as a designer and design researcher, it's like you have to understand that you're not necessarily coming with a solution to fix something, but you are creating a problem space. What it actually means is like, sorry, asking what is the issue, what's the problem first, making a problem. So it's not just solving this. It's what you do is start to, it's an act of problem making, and it might involve deconstructing the briefs that you got, or the assumptions that the people involved, the stakeholders involved in that situation, came with. So part of what you do is to problematize and deconstruct that. And that's not always easy, because you need to have those kind of both the theoretical and ethical lenses while you're looking at that, and it goes back to the thing we talked about multidisciplinarity, the interdisciplinarity. That's the importance of that. So if you are a design student, you don't have that kind of grasp of those kind of critical literatures that enable you to do that, then it's very, very difficult to be able to kind of to engage in that. So it tells you that there's also some work to do in enriching the design curriculum when it comes to the ability for students to think more critically, to problematize the context in which they're working in. And then, of course, in another way, one thing I think, and it's also been very, very much talked about in this fields of participative design, co-design, is about participation and power. That's a very, very important issues that come up in relation to that. So, for example, you talked about a subdisciplinary participative design. There's a lot about focus on participation and making sure that the stakeholders in a particular endeavor are involved on equal level. But there's a failure to actually put that into practice when you move away from the Scandinavian traditions those practices were developed in Scandinavia. When you move, for example, to Scandinavia to kind of a different context, you discover that those kind of things very, very, it's very difficult to apply them. So, for example, you see many, many projects that are carried out by researchers from, let's say, Nordic countries, in African countries. Their funding, for example, it comes from a Norwegian research body, and they would have specified the kinds of deliveries that you have to make. So you go to, for example, to Namibia, say, another country, and you want to engage in participatory design. So you come into a situation, and first of all, because of your funding, it's like it tells you what kind of projects that you have to be interested in. So instead, propose something to a local community. Of course, I mean, they will go along. And that situation itself just puts a lot of questions about power and participation and the value of local participation in that kind of that situation. So you would go through the motions and involve people and hear their voices, and you engage in kind of design work. And then after that, you leave and you go back and you write your papers and you publish them. And then you say you've done participated in that. So first of all, the agendas are not participatory. The definition of problems are not participatory.
Yeah.
The power relations within the field when you're kind of doing design work is not equal, because somebody comes with money and prestige and all that. And they're working with people that are not necessarily kind of. So the power relations are unequal. And then they will get to produce knowledge about that. He's a researcher that comes from these countries. And so that's those kind of situations. And they're going to write that the research was participatory. But the question is like, yeah, how participatory was it? It's not to say no, you can't just go and do research and do work, valuable work in other places. But it's been having the ability to recognize the position you're in, the positionality of you as a researcher, of you as a specialist intervening in the context that's different from yours. Having the ethical responsibility and the sincerity to just recognize that, I think it's itself is important.
I feel like it puts the designer or the researcher, design researcher or professional in that situation in a very negotiating position to be able to balance these things.
Yeah, that's an interesting point because it's like that's the role of design as a negotiator. I think it's very important because in many and with going back to user-centered, human-centered, all these kind of versions of design, you are the idea usually is to do something that's of value to the user, right?
Mm.
You involve the user to do some value, but in many cases you are working with other stakeholders with different interests. So if you want to produce something that of value to a user in a particular situation, and where you're working, the ownership of whatever you're making shared with other parties that have interests, and then the interests of the user, being able to make visible the complex nature of that landscape. I think that's something that designers could be kind of much more, could get more, much better at doing. Just making visible the landscape of relations and power positions that are involved in a particular situation which they're intervening in. Even though what you do might not necessarily alter the interests or alter the motivations of the different stakeholders, making things visible and bringing kind of deconstructing the situation and bringing a new set of problematics on the table, I think it's one of the most important things that you can do as a designer. Helping people to ask the right question, for example.
That is really helpful. And you know, I think it's important for us to keep interrogating and talking about the complexities of doing this work and recognizing that just because participatory design or co-creation is looked upon more favorably, that we don't just think of it as a check mark, that we recognize that there are actual people involved here, that there are crazy power dynamics from involved and designers being a part of making those visible. I agree, is a fantastic way for us to start to lay the foundation for that work.
In my work, the work I mentioned, my collaboration with artists. So one of the things I've been trying to do is to not just collaborate with non-academics, like for example, the work I've done with artists, but trying to produce knowledge together. So there's one example of that is an artist academic article that I'm writing together with the artist I've collaborated with, and getting her to contribute. But we have realized that, and I think that's something that we're discussing with the reviewers of the article, that just the idea of inviting a non-academic to write an academic journal in itself problematic. Because I have turned many, many years of knowledge of writing that genre, and they don't. And the requirements of publication that genre might kind of lead them to change the form of actually how they want to express themselves. So that in itself is always a very, very problematic situation in terms of power relations. So when you bring that, we're talking about power relations and participation, right? When you want to do this kind of something like that, you cannot consider that to working on equal terms, because you as an academic has a kind of a different kind of areas. But we also do it into like exhibitions, right? And that's creating work together. And that will also be a kind of another example where the academic doesn't kind of doesn't occupy that powerful position. So if when we're writing the article in an academic journal, I might have power.
Mm.
And there'll be somebody that. But when we are producing like an exhibition together, I'm not just an expert in that. So I just play a kind of background role, and they had it for. So that's with the extra expertise. So thinking about in that sense, actually one way which I try to address that problem that we have just talked about. It's still work in progress. It's not always easy. I'm doing that because I want to explore what's possible.
Having spoken about the urgent need for African design and architecture to be documented and archived,
what is the role of the internet and social media in translating and communicating African design knowledge to the young people, first in Africa and eventually the rest of the world?
I would say, first of all, regarding to the internet, that is, we have to realize that it's not everybody has access to the internet. Even in this day,
not everybody has access to it. Yes.
And so there's even having access and also full access is something else.
Yes.
Because there's still many limitations
levels.
Maybe like low kind of connectivity. There's probably some people that have to pay for units to access. And not everybody has able to access all the features of the internet and social media, for example. So that's, so the first is a question of access. But you have to recognize that, yes, it's a, become very, very, very big and useful platform for kind of sharing the knowledge and for giving some people, not everybody, but giving some people a voice. People that would not be able to have an audience if you relied only on traditional media. So that's pretty evident. So in that sense, yes, you could see the internet as a platform where you could kind of make visible and communicate those forms of knowledge that kind of have been hiding in the margins. Yes. But at the same time, you have to think about the fact that there are so many limitations on our ability to do so, because not everybody has access to the internet. Not everybody has the skills to communicate and to catch a big audience, because that's also a skill, right? In this social media age where we hear about influencers, people making things going very well. So those platforms also have a lot of power in decision making about what is visible and what is not, what is prioritized and what is not. So it's not just a transparent medium, right, where you post something out and what you post in comes out the same way. There's a lot of regulating mechanisms that, we talk a lot about algorithms, but that's just one of them. But there are many other kind of mechanisms that these platforms use to be able to decide what is visible and what is not. So we have to also recognize the power of those platforms when you're thinking about the potential of internet, right, and social media. In spite of all that, it gives quite a lot of people a voice and an audience and where they would alternative not have been able to have. So in that sense, that's valuable. But we have to think of other, not everything that's can be communicated through text and video and picture, right? So there's other forms of, so that's the thing about the challenges. Like, what about the oral traditions and oral forms of kind of communication? How to communicate that? It's not always evident. So that's the question. That's a question mark relation to that. So my answer to you is that there are possibilities, and you've identified the social media as one of the possible kind of venues where you could make improvements in terms of what's available and what can be shared among audiences. But there's still many, many challenges.
Yeah.
And the answer to that is difficult, I would say.
Mm. You talk about the other ways, because I feel like we need to document first before we start sharing, so that we know that we have internalized, appreciated, and have the pride in that before we can share it with the rest of the world.
That's definitely a kind of something that's necessary to do. We have to do more of. We have to be able to communicate forms of knowledge that are embedded within people's bodies and people's practices, for example. We have to be able to do a better job of doing that. And that's not always easy. And also, but I would say that in going back to the internet and social media, there's been quite a lot of interesting developments in that regard, because there's a lot of information and knowledge that you can find. And I'm not sure it's been fully explored. Unfortunately, we have to also recognize the class nature of access to these kinds of platforms, social media. Mm-hmm. Who is it that's on social media posting stuff? It's not everybody. Mm-hmm. It's not the person that's in the village working on the farm.
Yeah, yeah.
It's usually the person that's maybe the person that's like in the job room or the kind of middle class, mostly the middle class people mm-hmm. that participate in this culture
mm-hmm.
by the internet. Mm-hmm. So it's still kind of, and you have to know the majority of the world is living on the margins.
Absolutely.
So not everybody, when we talk about Africans, not all, the majority of we talk about Africans don't have the same interests as we, for example, us.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of diversity, not just we from country to country, but from culture to culture, but in terms of class, it's a big diversity in terms of that.
Yes.
So what you see, and just it goes to the point, what you see, what's available now, it's coming majority, for the most part, from just a limited group of people.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a lot of voices that are not being heard. Those voices are not necessarily interested in being heard by.
Exactly. And we can't even from a research perspective just only rely on social media to paint us a picture of a place. I think we're starting to see that become an issue where, yes, whereas there's a genuine excitement around how social media has given a platform and voice to a lot of people that, you know, wouldn't have had that platform before, we're also seeing an issue where now people are taking what they see on social media as everything. So you see representations of Africa on social media and assume you have the full picture, but you're right, this is like only maybe less than a 10% of of what, you know, our cultures and ways of life look like, you know. So we need to see it as just one way, one approach, but not shy away from all other approaches of understanding a people and learning about those contexts.
Assumption about this is that we have to make certain knowledge available to the center, right? We're talking about Facebook, we're talking about, in this area. That's the center. And maybe the center is not actually, that's the most important thing we're speaking about.
Yes.
It's more about how does knowledge being shared in around the margins.
Yeah.
That I think that should be kind of also something that we tell here. So it's, there's this notion that we need to provincialize the West, for example, to decenter the West or Europe, for example. They don't see this as, okay, what you have to be like, to talk to that center in order to make it relevant. So the center and the periphery, that dichotomy, that interrelation is also very important to think about. And that when you're thinking about, and I think that is very important, because we can, one assumption, what we are talking about right now is that we have to make knowledge that's available somewhere and make it available somewhere else. Where is that somewhere else that kind of really so important that it should be, that should be available at?
Mm.
Should be on Facebook, for example. What is it? Who is on Facebook? So if we say to make everything available on Facebook, who do you want to see? When there's nobody has access to Facebook, for example.
Exactly.
There's a lot that's happening on the margins
that we're missing.
We can miss it. And all we are missing, even though we that want this kind of, this calling for this need to kind of really go away from the center, kind of really matter, we actually are also positioned in a particular way. I'm always interested in the position of somebody like me in relation to Africa.
Yeah.
Because I left Cameroon about 20 years ago.
Right.
And I don't know, I have a kind of very ambivalent relationship with Cameroon right now, for example.
Mm.
And I'm not so sure I'm in touch, so well in touch with the current state of things.
Mm-hmm.
And I will get to understand what you mean to see your own supposedly homeland from the outside.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
And we have to recognize that we have changed. We have changed. time happens, things happen very fast, especially in Africa where things change so fast.
Mm-hmm.
It changes so fast that if you are not really on the putting hand the pulse of what's happening,
mm-hmm.
you change after a while. You actually kind of you are looking at it from the outside.
Mm-hmm. But that also gives you a new positioning and
positionality. And very interesting. It's just a position, actually.
Yeah. It's a place of privilege too, you know, and provides new opportunities of how you might, you know, engage with homeland, interrogate, contribute to. It really opens up a new opportunity.
And absolutely, and actually, it means that I always want to adopt a position of humility.
Yes.
When I'm very careful of who I'm speaking for.
Mm-hmm.
Because usually you are being asked to speak on behalf of some.
Absolutely.
Where you're from.
Yes. And
I'm not so sure I'm qualified. I'm very, very humble when it comes to that. I'm being always clear and kind of clear about making that clear that it's like, this is my position, the position from where I speak.
Yes. And in fact, even more than that, you start to represent a whole continent.
Yes.
You know, not even just Cameroon. You're seen as the Africa now. Like, you represent a whole continent. And I think people cannot, especially us in the diaspora, we cannot get tired of reminding people that we speak from a very specific and unique perspective. And that, yes, I know, and it's cliche to say Africa is not a country, but really people need to be reminded over and over again.
I know.
It's a continent.
That concept of the circle and then the peripherals and that communication, wow, you know? And and thank you for reminding us of that, always placing ourselves and seeing our position, you know? Where are we? Mm-hmm. And the play of power in human-centered design or core design. Always nice to have a researcher, you know, because they also come in with a different perspective, mostly an analytical one. But like you said, the play between the professions, you know, and how easily your position, your power and your position changes, you know, when you work with another profession, from superior to inferior in that case. And, you know, from the teacher to the student. What is the African aesthetic for you?
That's a difficult question. Well, I would say there are African aesthetics, and it's hard to define those. I think that what you would put under that label are a certain product of certain shared experiences and histories and ways of being and making that have existed over periods of time. You talked about from pre-colonial time, but that's still just looking in measuring, like looking at it from like using the colonial as the benchmark for measuring. But there's, I mean, this is like, this is, we said that this civilization started in Africa, right? So if that's the case, then it starts from the beginning of civilization. That kind of, that evolution of that history, that Jewish history that's happened.
Mm-hmm.
And it's involved a lot of people moving from one place to another. And I think what's African in that sense is about that shared history. And that has affected people in different ways.
I think we asked that question because it's something we're wrestling with ourselves. And I think getting multiple perspectives on what that even means, and for a lot of people on the continent and in the diaspora, is interesting. Some people arrive to that easy and they're like, oh, for me, the African aesthetics is XYZ. For other people, it's like, I don't even know if I understand what, you know, that, if it's even possible to define that, because again, like, you know, we're saying like it's Africa is like it's a wealth of a lot of people,
I'm not even sure myself that I actually know the answer to that,
because right, and that's
what I've told you. What I have told you so far is my conception of what I understand African in that aesthetic.
Yes, absolutely.
I've said okay, this is I think it's about aesthetics, not aesthetic.
Yes.
Aesthetics.
Yeah.
But I also talk a lot about what is African in that.
Right.
I'm not going into the aesthetics part of it. This is another long kind of long yes.
Yes.
So it's, I mean, it's difficult. I cannot put words to that at the moment, but that's the thoughts that come to your mind when you're asking.
Yeah. Yeah. And I also think about what you said about, like, you know, maybe like in some ways it could be like Africa from the outside looking in, also from versus Africa from the inside looking out, you know, because,
yes.
you know, I think we're seeing a lot of schools of thought that are, I think of people like Saki Mafundikwa, Professor Mugendi, who are looking at actually Africa with a K versus Africa with a C.
Yes.
Absolutely. And so it's fascinating. We love to just like engage.
And so, just one. So it's like this understanding that it's not a geographical location based set of interrelated relations that cut across different locations and kind of they feed and they go back and forth and crisscross each other. So we have the diaspora, diasporas that were produced by slavery. There's those diasporas that were produced by recent migration to different parts of the world. All of that.
Yes. Wow. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to just chat with us, to have this conversation. And we look forward, like Eunice said, to having you back and continuing these conversations. Maybe by that time you'd have more answers to a lot of the many and more questions even.
More questions, yeah. More likely. Thanks so much for having me, and it's been a pleasure talking to you. And I like the questions because I had not necessarily thought about all these things that we talked about before our conversation. So I love the kind of opportunity to be able to think about, because what I've been doing is just thinking on my feet while we're talking.
It's cool.
And those kind of things are just my thoughts are not necessarily rehearsed or in my mind. I'm just responding and thinking as we are talking, and I think that's very, very. I enjoyed it.
Well, thank you very
and
much.
And I would love to come in, love to come again and talk to you by the opportunity, gentlemen.
If you enjoyed listening to this episode, please join us for more conversations and interviews with African educators, creatives, architects, urban planners, and designers as they share their knowledge and experiences about practicing in Africa and the diaspora.
Remember to subscribe, leave a review, or share this podcast with other people that might be interested in this content. Thank you for joining us today.